You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of We Need to Talk About Ezra by Julie Miller. Miller was accompanied by Dakota Iron Eyes, whom the actor met at a protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016. In Hawaii, the actor repeatedly claimed to be acting as Iron Eyes' adopted guardian, though the teen is alleged to have gone without a phone, money, underwear, socks, or even shelter. The duo lived like drifters, sleeping some nights in a polyester tent pitched atop a volcano. There was this intensely controlling behavior of Takata, which, at first, I thought was for Takata's own good because they were unstable, says someone who witnessed it. But their perspective changed when Iron Eyes' parents petitioned for the protective order, claiming that Miller used violence, intimidation, threat of violence, fear, paranoia, delusions, and drugs to hold sway over a young adolescent, Takata. Iron Eyes has told Insider that their parents conducted a disgusting and irresponsible smear campaign against Miller, adding that the actor in multiple cases has done the right thing and stood in protection of others. It was a strange pairing in Hawaii, a nearly 30-year-old Hollywood actor and a teenage activist. But Miller spun the relationship, say four people. The story I heard was that Iron Eyes was fleeing a family background that was intolerant of their sexuality or gender identity, says a longtime friend. That's a compelling story in 2022. I bought it. Iron Eyes' mother refutes this. We simply want Takata to be independent, safe, and happy. We don't want a 30-year-old man or person manipulating and or taking advantage of her. The situation with Iron Eyes' family is not uncomplicated. Their father, Chase Iron Eyes, pled guilty to burglary and three other felonies in 2003. He since reinvented himself as a political leader and taken what some believe is a not entirely selfless interest in Iron Eyes' activism career. In 2019, Takata rallied thousands at the Women's March and the Global Climate Strike and appeared on Christiane Amanpour's PBS series. In December 2021, they were interviewed by Angelina Jolie as one of 17's Voices of the Year. In late March, a year ago, Miller and Iron Eyes were in Hawaii at the Hilo Farmers Market when they befriended a member of a polygamous family on the east side of the island. The family has a small booth, and the actor told them that they wanted to trade their Hollywood career for a simple Hawaiian storefront and needed merchandise to stock. Miller also mentioned that they were with a companion who needed the actor's help and that the pair was having issues with lodging. He acted like he was a righteous man or a man of God, and he's helping this woman out. She needs some safety, says the family patriarch, who asked not to be identified by name and has had legal issues of his own, including a domestic abuse case that is still pending. The man and his four wives, including the aforementioned Anna, invited the pair to stay on the property with them and their four young children. Strange things happened almost immediately. Miller returned to the house one day following what they said was a run-in with cops, complaining about being unfairly targeted and carrying an armload of toys for the kids. He bought Nerf guns for our children and was mansplaining about guns, says another wife, Kaylin. The actor recruited women to help them chainsaw guava trees in the backyard and build a sweat lodge. One day, while strolling a strip mall with the polygamous patriarch, Miller spontaneously bought him a $2,000 diamond and ruby-encrusted gold lion ring from Kay Jewelers. Miller proposed merging families, according to the father. It was like, we should be partners forever. I want to take you all around the world, says the patriarch. And I didn't decline it. I knew the kind of state he was in. Kaylin says that Miller expressed that they had experienced a lot of trauma and weird shit in the Hollywood scene. And we were like, hell yeah, we'll help you out. Speaking to Playboy in 2018, Miller said, I've survived abuse for sure in a lot of capacities, starting from a pretty young age. About 2 weeks after they arrived, Miller and Iron Eyes suddenly left. Family members allege that the actor took Anna, the 25-year-old wife in the home, and her three children with them. While Miller was in Hawaii, sources say the actor's divorced parents flew to the island to try to help. Later, Miller showed friends an intensely awkward video they'd made of the tearful family reunion. They laughed as they queued it up. He was like, isn't this the most effed up shit you've ever seen? Says someone who was there. The source says that Miller has bragged about punishing their father in the wake of the divorce. He was like, nobody's ever been treated as badly as I've treated Bob Miller in the past year. He was like, I think it's going to make us ultimately much closer in the future. The source says the situation is similar to what many people who have spent time with the actor have experienced. The way I describe it is, it's like you're in a non-consensual emotional BDSM relationship with Ezra. Another source in Hawaii asked whether he ever witnessed any altercations involving Miller, cuts to the chase even quicker. Every interaction with Ezra is an altercation. A Hornet's Nest, July 2022, Vermont. What's good? What's good? What's good? Anna was doing an Instagram Live from Miller's farm. Since she joined Miller, she and others in the strange caravan had been the subject of social media attacks, and she wanted to tell her side of the story. Ezra effing saved my life, she said. She'd been stripping to pay the bills and had started an OnlyFans account. She hadn't even had enough money to buy diapers, she added. Now y'all want to call Ezra a cult leader, she said. Before she could go on, a small voice chimed in off screen. Mom? In early August, after the police were dispatched to the mountain with the order to transfer Anna's children to the state, the actor began working with a publicist specializing in crisis management. Though Miller has interfaced with police in at least three precincts in an array of arrests, the actor's legal problems, through good luck or good lawyering, have mostly gone poof. Vanity Fair has seen one non-disclosure agreement and heard of a handful of others in what three sources describe as a whack-a-mole-style legal strategy of paying off alleged victims. Miller declined comment. No charges were pressed in Iceland. In Hawaii, Miller paid a $500 fine after pleading no contest to a disorderly conduct charge related to the karaoke arrest as part of a plea deal where other charges were dropped. Other allegations in Hawaii about Miller hurling a chair at a woman and breaking into a couple's home, shouting obscenities and stealing a passport and other legal documents were subsequently dropped. A source close to that couple refused to comment, but warned Vanity Fair, don't poke a hornet's nest because one stung a few people. Miller is scheduled to appear in Vermont court on September 26th, and that would have been September 26th of 2022, for an arraignment on a felony burglary charge related to the alleged breaking and entering and theft of alcohol. Miller's representative says the actor was cooking with their mother, needed rice wine, and grabbed that and another bottle of wine from the home of a close childhood friend. The rep says Miller did not realize that the friend didn't want to be friends anymore. The restraining order in Massachusetts concerning the non-binary 12-year-old will be enforced through June 2023, according to a source close to the situation. The actor's rep dismisses the allegation, saying Ezra's lack of interest clearly upset a disappointed fan when they would not engage with the fan or her daughter. The local police department confirmed it has an active case involving Miller and the 12-year-old based on three interactions the child had with the actor in April, May, and June of 2022. The actor has not been charged with any crimes relating to Anna's children. Despite being concerned, Anna's husband, the polygamist, still believes in the integrity of the connection he made with Miller and is still wearing the gold lion ring the actor gave him. Online, Miller's fans battle negative headlines on the star's behalf. People who have spoken out against Miller on record or supported their alleged victims have been attacked and doxxed on Twitter. I know Johnny Depp has a lot of fans and stuff, says a person close to Miller, who claims that Miller's fans are even more dedicated. People devote their time to do this at a time when it's needed. In early August, Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav told investors that he was bullish on The Flash and that the movie would go forward with its 2023 theatrical release. The Hollywood Reporter, however, reported that Warner Brothers had discussed scrapping the film. 4 days later, Miller released their contrite statement about addressing their complex mental health issues. The notion that The Flash was at risk was a wake-up call, says the actor's rep. Miller and their CAA agent even made a trip to the studio's Burbank, California headquarters to apologize for the negative PR in person and express renewed commitment. The actor is now said to be working with producers on The Flash to shoot additional scenes. Some friends say Miller has been so creative with the truth in the past and so cavalier about getting mental health treatment that they have a hard time taking the statement seriously. If he is going through therapy, says one, he's just acting through it. But Miller's spokesperson insists they are taking their therapy and treatment very seriously. Many people hope that's true. Mary Harron, American Psycho, directed the actor for 3 days when they played a young Salvador Dali in Daliland. They were very professional and nice to everybody, she has told Vanity Fair. There was no trouble or a sign of trouble on set. So it was very upsetting and terrible to read what happened later. Hopefully, they are getting help for what sounds like a very, very serious break. It doesn't matter how talented someone is. If they've done anything wrong, they have to face it. Clearly, this is not just a young star acting out. This seems like something that needs a serious intervention, which I hope has happened. As this story went to press, Vanity Fair exchanged messages with Miller's former fiancé, Erin, who asked to be identified only by her first name and whom the actor was dating when they began playing The Flash in 2016. The Ezra I knew wasn't violent or physically abusive toward anyone, she says. To think back is painful, because we had a deep love and he was good to me. But she does remember darkness after the breakup. For years he convinced me and all our friends that I was abusive. But looking back, I would be calling out his disrespect and he wouldn't take responsibility and just call me abusive because of my reaction. I could have handled it better. I didn't know the term gaslight back then. I was emotionally effed up for years. She says that Miller broke up with her after hiring a spiritual advisor who told the actor that she was a parasite. When the allegations of Miller being abusive to others surfaced, she admits she was hit with a sick relief. Maybe I wasn't the abusive one after all. Aaron's feelings are complicated now. I can make excuses for him all day, but I don't want to anymore, she says. The illusions of grandeur need to be called out. I will love Ezra always, and I don't want him to continue down this dark road. For this article, additional reporting by Anthony Bresnikan and Savannah Walsh. Forward Vision. Annie Leibovitz turns her lens on 8 of the most influential female artists of our time. Essay by Thelma Golden. First photo, Cindy Sherman at home in Long Island, New York. In the title of her seminal 1971 essay, art historian Linda Nochlin posed a question that would challenge the art world fundamentally. Why have there been no great women artists? A rhetorical question, but no less profound for the way it pushed us to acknowledge the great omissions of art history. Of course there had been great women artists. Through the work of pioneering scholars, courageous curators, and brave institutions, we have benefited from a radical re-envisioning of art history that laid bare profound exclusions. This work of a generation has given the opportunity to celebrate those women whose presence and practice were forgotten, to honor their contributions, and to acknowledge these artists who've paved the way for reinvention and reimagination. Those unwavering pioneers shaped an understanding of art at its most expansive and also mark the history still being made in this moment, such as Simone Lee's presentation at this year's Venice Biennale, the first black woman to be selected to represent the United States. Working across many visual vocabularies, the eight artists featured here collectively represent the phenomenal trajectory of the last half century. They have received widespread recognition for practices that have magnificently engaged media, pioneered new forms, and expressed radical subjectivities around history, gender, race, and identity, while expanding representations of women in the world of art and beyond. With their visions and their voices and the beautiful and bold intellectual space their work creates, they allow for the rich joys and profound complexities of any and all of the roles they inhabit. Makers, thinkers, mothers, sisters, daughters, advocates, activists, friends, and citizens. It is this quality, this deep-seated power, that allows these women creators to envision possibilities and bring to light realities that have been erased, forgotten, if not discarded, for all to experience. Through their practice, they galvanize the capacity to probe the very constructions of identity in the world around us and to create something wholly original from it. Not only do these artists honor and embody the spirit of the great women who came before them, but through their art making, they have created extraordinary space for themselves and for generations to come. Next photos, Simone Lee in her studio in Brooklyn. Faith Ringgold at home in Inglewood, New Jersey. Ronnie Horn in her studio in New York City. Micheline Thomas in her studio in Brooklyn. Kathy Kollwitz and Frida Kahlo of Guerrilla Girls in Brooklyn. And Amy Sherald in her childhood home in Columbus, Georgia. the fight ahead. The Supreme Court's decision to end federal protections for abortion access didn't just rewind the clock 50 years. It opened a Pandora's box of confusing, potentially life-threatening legal complications. Vanity Fair talks with five women on the front lines, by Abigail Tracy and Aaron Vanderhoof, with photographs by Diana Markosian and Drew Donovan. Opening photo, Eye of the Storm, Caitlin Bernard, MD, who provided abortion care to a 10-year-old rape victim in Indianapolis. Caitlin Bernard, MD, physician, Indiana. Tattooed on Caitlin Bernard's left foot is the image of a coat hanger and the words "Trust Women." The 38-year-old Indiana-based OBGYN got it years ago. It was intended as a reminder of life before Roe v. Wade. Bernard has long paired her medical career with advocacy. She was a plaintiff in an unsuccessful 2019 American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit to reverse Indiana's near-total ban on second trimester abortions. Post-Roe, Indiana became the first state to pass an abortion ban. Now, Bernard is girding for another legal fight, this time against Republican Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita, who, she says, maligned her practice as Bernard became a lightning rod in one of the most publicized cases after the Dobbs decision stripped federal abortion protections and turned the country into a patchwork of disparate laws. Bernard is the doctor who gave a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio an abortion and spoke to the Indianapolis Star about the devastating case. Overnight, Bernard was forced into a glaring spotlight, a martyr to one side and a villain to the other. It was very scary, not knowing exactly what was going to happen, not knowing if this was going to impact my ability to continue working where I work, my ability to continue seeing patients, she says. And certainly I was scared for my personal safety, for the safety of my family. For weeks, conservative politicians and members of even mainstream media sowed doubt that such a victim even existed. On national television, Ohio Attorney General David Yost said his office hadn't heard a whisper about the case. The Washington Post turned a suspicious fact-checker on the story. Then the Columbus Dispatch reported that 27-year-old Gerson Fuentes confessed to police that he raped the girl on at least two occasions. As the truth sank in where it hadn't before, ire shifted to Bernard. Rokita opened an investigation, claiming the doctor had failed to report that abortion and others to the state. Official records show otherwise. Bernard cried defamation. The amount of work that we have to put in for each individual patient to be able to get the care that they need is really tremendous. Bernard, who previously worked in Missouri before joining Indiana University, says, "That's what people in all of these abortion-restrictive states face, a mountain of hurdles just to try to get basic health care for their patients." Even as she has faced threats, she had to hire security. More than fear, Bernard feels exhaustion. We're already having such a difficult time trying as hard as we can to take care of as many patients as we can, she says, of both working in Indiana and in Missouri. It really solidified my understanding of how important it was to have providers in those states, and not just providers of abortion access, but also providers of whole reproductive health, she says. People sometimes ask, why do we become advocates? Why is advocacy part of our job? And the reality is that we would all prefer to just be able to take care of our patients, she says. That's why we became physicians. Up to the challenge, in the courts, with so-called trigger bans and, in some cases, abortion restrictions more than a century old in effect, many legal battles are still being fought in the courts in Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Ohio, among other states. In Idaho, for instance, the U.S. Justice Department sued the state, arguing its law would prevent emergency room doctors from performing abortions needed to stabilize a woman's health. In August, a federal court narrowly blocked a provision in the law saying doctors could not be legally punished for protecting the health of a pregnant patient. On the ballot, over the summer, Kansas voters were the first to take abortion rights to the ballot box, and they fiercely rejected an initiative that would have stripped the right to an abortion from the state constitution. Abortion remains protected under the state constitution for up to 22 weeks. Ballot measures that could curb abortion access have also been introduced in Kentucky and Montana. In Kentucky, a constitutional amendment to include language stating that Kentucky's constitution does not secure or protect a right to abortion or funding of abortion is on the ballot. In Montana, voters will decide whether to give legal personhood to infants born alive at any stage of development following induced labor, C-section, and attempted abortion. The law sets a $50,000 fine and 20-year maximum prison sentence for violators. Meanwhile, voters in Vermont and California will decide whether to enshrine abortion protections in their state constitutions. In Congress, the Women's Health Protection Act failed in the Senate last May. The Ensuring Access to Abortion Act passed in the House in July. It has yet to receive a vote in the Senate. Fatima Goss Graves, National Women's Law Center President, Washington, D.C. It was shocking to see those words on paper. Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, says of the Dobbs decision. She sees the country grappling not just with a public health crisis, but a legal one, too. The deep reliance on the norms of 1865, a time where women in this country were not allowed to vote, weren't allowed to own property, weren't allowed to even practice law. Those were the norms that had to guide a decision in 2022. Goss Graves, a longtime gender justice advocate and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, took over the NWLC in 2017. A graduate of Yale Law School, Goss Graves, 46, cut her teeth clerking for Judge Diane Wood of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and as a litigator before establishing herself as one of the foremost voices on women's and gender issues. Though she's been sounding the alarm for years, the fall of Roe hit Goss Graves hard. I, on the day of the Dobbs decision, found myself feeling like I had been punched in the gut, she says. I knew how many people were terrified for themselves, and I know how deeply personal abortion is, whether people tell their abortion stories or not. Everyone has one. Goss Graves operates alongside D.C. power brokers and often testifies before Congress and federal agencies. In the aftermath of Dobbs, her organization has worked closely with the Biden administration, which was criticized for appearing flat-footed in its response to the highly anticipated ruling. Among the NWLC's recommendations was for the Department of Health and Human Services to issue guidance to physicians on providing abortion care in emergency cases, which was adopted in July. We will continue our advocacy for a focused effort, both publicly and quietly, including toward the White House and importantly across agencies, she says. The path forward is unclear, Goss Graves says, but the goal is to amend the Constitution to enshrine the protections Roe had provided. Our ultimate North Star is that abortion should be available and accessible to all who want it, Goss Graves says, whether that means deploying an existing network of lawyers to give legal advice to healthcare providers and individuals, or educating businesses on their powers. A critical piece of the puzzle, Goss Graves explains, is working to destigmatize abortion. Turning it into something shameful has been a successful tactic by those who want to continue to oppress, she says. She's also looking ahead to future battles, like the right to contraception. I have been, in these last few months, watching our legal system absorb this shock on top of the individuals, Gosgrave says. And lawyers like certainty, right? When you're in the business of building your advice on past practice and precedent, you like certainty. And so we're also in this situation where our very foundations that have undergirded the rule of law, that have sort of allowed us to feel very stable around the advice we give around what the parameters are, all of that also feels fragile and not secure. What I know is that in the end, we will win. And so the question is just going to be, you know, what is the timetable? When does it happen? A Lifetime of Roe, 1962, The Defenders brings abortion to network TV. The drama lost three of its advertisers after it became the first primetime show to mention abortion. 1965, Griswold versus Connecticut. The Supreme Court rules Connecticut has no right to ban contraceptives for married couples, reinforcing the constitutional right to privacy for when individuals make personal decisions about having a kid. 1969, National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, NARAL, is founded. 1970, Hawaii and New York become the first states to legalize abortion. 1971, United States versus Vuitch. In its first case about abortion, the Supreme Court upholds a Washington, D.C. law prohibiting abortions with an exception for the woman's health, and concludes that a woman's health encompasses psychological and physical well-being. 1973, Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court's landmark decision invalidates a Texas abortion ban and grants federal protections for abortion prior to a fetus's viability. 1979, Baptist televangelist Jerry Falwell mobilizes conservative Christian voters behind the moral majority. 1982, the Federalist Society holds its first meetings. 1992, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. The Supreme Court upholds the right to an abortion, but introduces the undue burden standard on state abortion regulations. 1995, Norma McCorvey recants. The woman previously known as Jane Roe says she regretted taking part in the abortion rights movement. She would later claim she was paid by the anti-abortion movement. 2000, an abortion pill is approved. 2003, President George W. Bush signs a partial birth abortion ban into law. 2009, late-term abortion doctor George Tiller is killed at his church. 2016, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. The Supreme Court reaffirms Roe and Casey. 2022, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. The Supreme Court upholds Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban and overturns Roe and Casey, ending federal protections for abortion rights. Opposing Force, Catherine Glenn Foster, President, Americans United for Life, Washington, D.C. In a July hearing about a post-Roe America, in front of the House Judiciary Committee, Catherine Glenn Foster left California Representative Eric Swalwell confused. Foster, a lawyer and the chief executive of Americans United for Life, had just said that a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio forced to travel across state lines for an abortion, the subject of a widespread news report, had technically not gotten an abortion. "Wait," said Swalwell, "it would not be an abortion if a 10-year-old with her parents made a decision not to have a baby that was the result of a rape?" Foster responded coolly and assuredly, "If a 10-year-old became pregnant as a result of rape and it was threatening her life, then that's not an abortion," she said, "so it would not fall under any abortion restriction in our nation." Foster's argument about the definition of abortion has become more commonplace in her movement in an attempt to put intent ahead of physical procedure. Foster and her group rhetorically exempt an array of situations, such as an ectopic pregnancy or a case like the 10-year-old's, from its legal definition of abortion. But the actual laws AUL advocates for are written in grayer terms. In Texas, such uncertainty around miscarriage and ectopic care has already led to increasing maternal morbidity. When AUL announced Foster's appointment in May 2017, board members praised both her legal mind and her willingness to tell her life story. In 2000, she accidentally became pregnant and went to an abortion clinic. She says she changed her mind as the procedure was about to begin and asked to leave. In interviews, often in Christian and Catholic news outlets, Foster goes on to describe a sadistic assault in which the doctor calls for nurses to hold her down as he aborted her pregnancy while she screamed. In a 2019 interview with Foster, the Daily Caller noted, due to the traumatic nature of the incident, Foster said she cannot recall the qualifications of staff in the abortion clinic and the name of the doctor. Founded in the years before Roe v. Wade, AUL quickly established itself as a major player in anti-abortion legal strategy, pushing successfully for informed consent laws and other barriers to access. In the 5 years since Foster was named the head of AUL, she has become a frequent guest at congressional hearings about reproductive health and abortion at the behest of Republican lawmakers. In statements submitted to lawmakers ahead of time, she shows off finely tuned legal argumentation befitting someone trained at the Georgetown University Law Center. In the chair, she uses more extreme, visceral language. Fetuses are torn limb from limb, she said, during a May 2022 House Judiciary Committee hearing. Bodies are thrown in medical waste bins, and in places like Washington, D.C., burned to power the lights of the city's homes and streets. Let that image sit with you for a moment. The next time you turn on the light, think of the incinerators. The fall of Roe appears to have expanded Foster's and her group's ambitions. Our workload just tripled, Foster told Catholic outlet Alitea, boasting about how many state abortion restrictions her group has inspired. And we're going to be in those blue states. We have a blue state strategy, and we're going to do everything we can to educate, to push back, to defend life. Catherine Colbert, retired reproductive rights attorney, Pennsylvania. The scene outside the Supreme Court was chaotic as media crews, reporters, and activists awaited a landmark decision. Catherine Colbert, the American Civil Liberties Union attorney who had argued the case on behalf of abortion providers and clinics, was bracing for the worst. But in a shocking turn, three justices appointed by Republican presidents, Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor, and David Souter, tipped the scales in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It was June 29, 1992. Roe versus Wade stood. The only inclination Colbert had received that perhaps she might prevail came from one of the opposing counsel, Kenneth Starr. As Colbert recalls it, he said, "The Court of Appeals has been vindicated," a hint that he had obviously seen the opinion, and it wasn't as I expected. But it was significant. The reality is we still had legal abortion for 30 years as a result of Casey, she says. Colbert, 70, grew up in Michigan and attended Cornell University before getting her law degree from Temple University. She was recruited to work as a staff attorney at the Women's Law Project in 1979. Her first day on the job, she was sent to the Philadelphia City Council to try to defeat an anti-abortion bill on behalf of abortion providers in the state. She was successful. In her career, she's argued on behalf of abortion providers in front of the Supreme Court twice. It's so personal, she says, explaining why she chose a career fighting to protect access to abortion. Everybody has a story. My mom had an abortion. My aunt had an abortion. My daughter had an abortion. I had a problem with a pregnancy. Everybody's story is a deep thing. She added, as a lesbian with a partner, now wife, two children, and now four grandchildren, I always cared deeply about reproductive freedom and the ability of all people to freely decide whether, when, how, and with whom to have children. In 1992, Colbert and a number of her colleagues from the ACLU co-founded the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, now known as the Center for Reproductive Rights, a global legal advocacy organization. From 1992 to 1997, Colbert headed the legal and policy teams, during which time the organization won two landmark cases in Alaska and Minnesota, strengthening abortion protections at the state level. Now retired, she has continued to speak publicly about the end of Roe, discussing with lawyers and activists across the country how to navigate the new landscape. Next photo, March of Time. Retired attorney Catherine Kitty Colbert, who co-founded the Center for Reproductive Rights in Portland, Oregon. Last year, Colbert and Julie F. Kay, a women's rights attorney and activist, co-wrote the book on it, Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. After a career of fighting these battles in the judicial system, she's had a change of heart. I learned from Casey and Dobbs that it is dangerous and foolish to depend solely on the courts to protect our reproductive freedoms, she says. The most effective safeguard is to maintain political power in all branches of government, particularly state legislatures and Congress. Since Donald Trump's election in 2016, Colbert had steeled herself all over again for the fall of Roe. But she says today's court is far different. Colbert wasn't prepared for the Dobbs ruling to be littered with what she has characterized as radical language. The Dobbs ruling created a roadmap on taking away other rights that are based on substantive due process, she says. It's just striking in its breadth. It also uses the language of the anti-abortion movement in a way that really confirms the partisan nature of the decision. Ultimately, in her view, the Constitution must be amended, an effort that has stalled at the federal level, with Republicans standing in staunch opposition and Democrats unable to overcome the Senate's 60-vote filibuster threshold on their own. It took our opponents 50 years to overturn Roe, and it may take us nearly that long to win back the legal protections we had that Roe gave us in their full sense. That's a long, long fight, she says. What do we ultimately need in the shorter term? We need to win that political power in the states and in Congress. And the only way to do that is hard work. It's not just one election. It is every election, every year. Marva Sadler, Senior Director of Clinical Services, Whole Woman's Health, Texas. When Marva Sadler first began working in reproductive health care, she didn't exactly understand the controversy she was diving into. I walked into my first day of work absolutely floored that there were protesters outside of the clinic. And by what they were saying, I could not believe that, she explained recently. Her upbringing in Waco, Texas, led her to see abortion as necessary, but not a topic of polite conversation. In a house with my mother and my grandmother and my two sisters, so a house full of women where it was just, we didn't talk about abortion. If you needed it, and that's what you wanted to do, you went and did that. There's no more time for subtlety, says Sadler. I'd like to think, in a perfect world, that there are people who could agree to disagree, but it's not enough to do that at this point, she says. My human rights need to be protected. My daughter's human rights need to be protected. My granddaughters, my future great-great-granddaughters, their rights should be protected. Whole Woman's Health has given its name to two major Supreme Court cases. Sadler is the senior director of clinical services for the entire organization. She took the job in 2008 after 3 years working at other clinics and has been immersed in the group's political project ever since. A major facet of the job is addressing racial disparities in maternal mortality and the inequities that women in poverty face. When Texas passed Senate Bill 8 in May 2021, the state banned abortion at approximately 6 weeks and made bounty hunters out of citizens who are authorized to sue anyone who helps provide an abortion, a doctor, a driver, someone who donates funds, and collect $10,000 or more if successful. Last spring, Sadler, alongside former gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis and two other advocates, became a plaintiff in a suit that challenged aspects of that law. Rupali Sharma, lead counsel on the case, Davis et al. Versus Sharp, says the law runs afoul of Texans' rights, even without federal abortion protections. You can't, without any connection to an incident, without any connection to someone, haul them into court and then get potentially hundreds and thousands of dollars, she says. For Sadler, the vitriol that some in her state have lobbed at her colleagues made her participation in the suit imperative. My husband asked me the same thing probably every day at this point. What made me decide to get involved in that, she says. It was time to step out into a different realm, to be a part of saying enough. Cece Caruso, organizing manager, Plan C, Nevada. About twice a month, Caitlin Cece Caruso logs in for a Zoom call from a bright Las Vegas workspace and gets face-to-face with a new batch of volunteers ready to be trained. In the calls, Caruso walks a couple dozen recruits through the basics of self-managed abortion while weaving a broader story about the reproductive justice movement and the way a generation of young activists are looking to understand the mistakes that led to the erosion of abortion rights. After the Dobbs draft decision leaked in May, the sessions grew larger and larger, and within 3 months, Caruso says, they had trained more than 1,500 people. Caruso, 25, is the digital organizing manager for Plan C, a political advocacy group that runs a website with up-to-date and accessible information about medical abortions. Its name is a play on Plan B, the brand name for a common form of emergency contraception. But Plan C, the abortion pills, works even after an embryo has implanted. Caruso's interest in policy and progressive advocacy was informed by a series of childhood experiences. They were in and out of homelessness in New York City until age 10, when their mom moved the family to Nevada. In middle school, they wanted to start a gay-straight alliance, and their principal blocked the effort. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.